Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Indolent Non-Hodgkin Lymphoma, or NHL. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 749 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, India, Ireland, Italy, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program has been made possible by Teva Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and about all those collaborating organizations that are really a resource for each of you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete your evaluation form. Your feedback is really very critical to us to be able to plan programs that are most helpful to you. And so we very much take to heart what you recommend or what your comments are, and we try very hard to implement the programs that you request. We are still planning many programs for this year, and so your recommendations couldn't be any more timely to send them in at this time for a program you'd like us to do. And indeed, the program today was one that many of you have asked for, and so we're offering it today. And so we try very hard to do what you ask us to do. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He's Associate Dean for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Medical College. He's Vice Chairman of Medicine for Clinical Research, Associate Director, Cancer Center, Chief Lymphoma Service, Attending Physician, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Leonard is going to address an overview of indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He's going to present on novel treatment approaches and the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Leonard.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and I'd like to reiterate my appreciation to you and the team at Cancer Care for putting together these programs, which I think have really been a great addition and value to patients, and I certainly hear from a number of patients that participate in them. It's also great to be here with my colleagues who are also speaking. I think this is a great topic, and I look forward to a lot of discussion. So just by way of introduction, I'm sure many of the people listening in have a lot of experience with indolent lymphoma, and others may be relatively new to thinking about this area. So to set the stage or the context for the discussion, lymphomas are tumors of the lymph tissue, and lymphomas occur when switches that regulate the growth of the lymphoma cells get broken. Those lymph cells grow. They turn into a lymphoma, I should say. And basically, most people will present with lymphoma with abnormal lymph node swelling, leading to a biopsy. Sometimes it can be other symptoms, pain, blood test abnormalities, or other abnormalities that are found in various organs. The most important thing in lymphoma is what type of lymphoma you're dealing with, because there are over 60 types of lymphoma. Most of them are non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, although there are also Hodgkin lymphomas. Most non-Hodgkin lymphomas are B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And within the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma B-cell group, a large percentage are what we call indolent lymphomas, and this is really the topic for today. So indolent lymphomas, by the name indolent being slow-growing, tend to be one of several different types of lymphomas. The most common indolent lymphoma is called follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There are several other subtypes of indolent lymphomas. One of them is called marginal zone lymphoma or MALT lymphoma. One of them is called small lymphocytic lymphoma that's related to something called CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So there are a number of different lymphoma subtypes that fall into this indolent slow-growing group. So the expectations with people with indolent lymphomas are that these are going to be, for most people, long-term issues, long-term disease issues, where these are lymphomas that tend to respond well to treatment. However, they tend to come back at some point, usually years later in the future. And these are diseases that for many, many people are chronic, slow-growing, managed disease on and off with treatment over the course of many years. And so these are diseases that most people should expect that they get to a point they need treatment. They typically respond to the treatment, but then sooner or later, years later, the disease comes back and may need further therapy. And so the point of this, and you can look at this as there are good things and bad things about indolent lymphoma, but the fact of the matter is you have to take the long view. And for some people, one way of thinking of this, not for everybody, but for some people, one way of thinking of this is that this is going to be something like high blood pressure, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, chronic long-term diseases, where the approach isn't just to do the right thing for today, but also to think to the future and to have a plan, then be prepared for things that you may have to deal with again in the future over a period of time. And so this is different from many other sorts of cancer where you generally rapidly and aggressively treat it. In indolent lymphoma, there are a number of different treatment options. And in fact, in some cases, it doesn't need treatment, even if the disease is present or even growing. And we'll come back to that in a second. So it's very important to know what type of lymphoma you're dealing with and if you're dealing with one of the indolent types. And then it's also very important to really focus on, and Dr. Call, I'm sure we'll come back to this a little bit later, what are your goals of treatment? So in indolent lymphoma, there are typically two questions. The first question is, do you need any treatment right now at any given point in time or not? And then the second question is, if you need treatment, what treatment do you do? So the first question is a difficult one for many people because we're used to the scenario of tumors, of cancers, where you say, well, I'm diagnosed, I have to aggressively treat it, find it early, go after it. But in fact, in indolent lymphomas, there is a lot of evidence out there that if the lymphoma is not causing any problems, if it seems to be growing slowly, if the lymph node enlargements are not big, the patient's not having symptoms, it might be reasonable to just watch it for a while. And in fact, for many people, a pattern of watch and wait or observing the disease and monitoring it without treating it is a very appropriate thing. And the reason is that for people who have disease that fits certain criteria, meaning that the disease is not causing any problems, is not causing any symptoms, is not large or affecting the person in a significant way, that in fact when you look 10 and 20, 30 years later in some cases, the survival, are people alive, can be quite similar, whether you immediately treat it or treat it at some point in the future. And so that is why that for many people it's appropriate to just observe the disease. Now for everyone, or for most people, perhaps not everyone, sooner or later the disease will reach a point that it needs treatment, and that may be at the time of diagnosis, that may be at some point later in the future. Then the second question that I alluded to is really what treatment do you choose? And the fact of the matter is the good part, although the complicated part of indolent lymphomas, is that we have a number of different treatment options. And so that may seem very confusing to patients. You may think your doctor doesn't know what they're doing because they don't know what the right treatment is. Well, in fact, it's not that there's any one right treatment for many situations. It's that there are a number of different potential treatment options for many patients. And I think of it as more of a negotiation or a partnership with the patient to talk about the patient's goals of therapy and how they want to approach the disease, because there can be, for many situations, a lot of flexibility to say, this is what I want to get out of the treatment. And I think Dr. Call will come back to that in more detail and give his perspectives on that. So when someone needs treatment, historically, people were treated with chemotherapy, and that goes back to at least the 1960s. There are a number of different chemotherapy options, some of which have been pills, some of which have been injections. They are typically outpatient treatments that don't necessarily or don't usually require being treated in the hospital. And there are a number of pros and cons of different regimens. Some of those regimens have fewer side effects. Maybe they're very easy for the patient to take. Maybe the side effects are quite manageable. Others may have more side effects, such as hair loss and low blood counts and infections. And the trade-offs tend to be, and this is generalizing, tend to be that stronger treatments tend to work longer as far as controlling the disease, but tend to have more side effects. And so the trade-off is, do I want to put up with more side effects to control the disease for a longer period, or fewer side effects, recognizing that the disease might come back sooner? So there are different chemotherapy regimens that have been used. One of them is called CHOP. That's a little bit more, I don't want to say aggressive, but is a little bit more involved treatment regimen. That is one that is associated with low blood counts and hair loss more commonly. There are lower dose versions of CHOP, such as a regimen called CVP, which has been used over many years. There's a drug called rituximab, which is an antibody treatment, an immune protein that works to fight the lymphoma and flick switches in the lymphoma cells to try to activate the immune system to fight the lymphoma and do a number of different effects. And so now when we give chemotherapy, we tend to give rituximab, this monoclonal antibody treatment, this immune protein treatment along with it. And then rituximab, for some people, can be used by itself as a without chemotherapy. And so there are pros and cons of these different approaches. One could use something like, let's say, R-CHOP, a combination of rituximab and chemotherapy. One could use rituximab alone, and that would perhaps be less effective, but be a little easier, a good bit easier to tolerate. In the long term, there's relatively little evidence that one of these treatments is better than another treatment in the long-term survival. Are you alive decades from now? But in the short term, there can be pros and cons of one versus the other. We now have an additional new drug, a drug called bendamustine, which is a chemotherapy drug, that is at least comparable to R-CHOP when you give it to patients with indolent lymphoma. And so R-CHOP and R-bendamustine are two also more commonly now used treatments, both as initial therapy and in the relapse disease setting. And so there are a number of options, and it's very important that patients sit with their physician and talk about their goals of treatment and talk about really what their priorities are. And again, this speaks to communicating with your healthcare team, and Dr. Call will also talk about this, because of the fact that your goal as a patient is really important in deciding how you choose these. Now, if the disease comes back down the line, and we expect in patients with indolent lymphoma that usually years later it will come back at some point, then further treatment might be needed, although there may be a period of time where patients can wait and be observed again because the disease isn't causing any problems. If the disease comes back and needs therapy, then the range of options are quite similar. One could give rituximab again or for the first time if it hadn't been given before. One can give R-CHOP chemotherapy. One can give R-bendamustine chemotherapy. There are certain situations where patients get more intensive treatments like bone marrow or stem cell transplants. There are versions of rituximab that are radioactive, called radioimmunotherapy, that add a radioactive particle to the immune treatment to try to make it work better. And there's a drug called Zevalin as an example of one of those. And then we have a number of new drugs that are either FDA approved for other types of lymphoma or in clinical trials that are quite promising. And I'm sure a little bit later in the time, either in Dr. Call's talk, he may allude to some of these when talking about clinical trials and in the question sessions. But we have a drug called lenalidomide, which is a cousin of thalidomide. That's a drug that's being studied in various forms at various times in indolent lymphoma as part of treatment. This is a pill that works in a little bit different way than chemotherapy. We have a category of drugs called kinase inhibitors. Kinases are switches in the lymphoma cells that regulate their growth. And there's a drug called idelalisib. There's a drug called ibrutinib. These are two examples of drugs that are kinase inhibitors. And these are drugs that are either approved or not yet approved for certain types of lymphoma that may ultimately prove to be useful in follicular lymphoma. And these and other new drugs are drugs that we are actively studying in a variety of clinical trials. So that's a bit of an overview and some of the novel treatments. I'm sure we'll have more time to come back to some of these areas in the questions in a little bit more depth, and I'm sure Dr. Call in a minute will highlight some of these issues as well during his portion of the discussion.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Lana. That was really excellent and a very comprehensive overview. And our next speaker is Dr. Brad Call, and Dr. Call is Skowronski Chair of Lymphoma Research, Associate Professor, University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, Associate Director for Clinical Research, UW-Carbone Cancer Center. And Dr. Call is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, your comfort level with adherence, and managing treatment side effects. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Call.
Thank you, Carolyn. Like John, I'm very delighted to have this opportunity today to talk to patients from around the country and around the world, patients and caregivers. And I'll start out by talking a little bit about clinical trials. Clinical trials turn out to be incredibly important part of what we do, and it's not always obvious or intuitive why we do clinical trials, so I thought I'd start with that. To put it very simply, Dr. Leonard and I would like to get smarter. And the way we do that is through the process of clinical trials. Really, everything that we know in 2014 about how to take care of lymphoma patients has been learned through the process of clinical research. And this has been going on now for over 40 years. And we have seen tremendous improvements in our treatments and in the outcomes for our patients. And this is all possible because of clinical research that has gone on over that period of time. And so it's really, I think, I'll speak for John and myself, it's incredibly gratifying for us as physicians to see studies that move the field forward because it's very, very gratifying to go and see our patients in clinic and talk to them about the improvements that we're seeing as a result of the clinical research that's taking place. So if you're a patient with an indolent lymphoma, you might have a discussion like this someday with your physician about participating in a clinical trial. And the question you might be wondering is, why should I do this? And there's several reasons, actually. One of the reasons is it's a chance to contribute something. It's a chance to contribute to the field. And like I will sometimes explain to patients, everything I know about how to treat you right now is because of patients who have gone before you, and they have participated in these clinical trials, and they've helped us get this information that's allowed you to benefit from that information right now. And this is a way for you to contribute to the field and do something that might help somebody else at some later time. And to put it quite honestly or quite bluntly even, I will say to patients sometimes, you know, this clinical trial, this research study, isn't really for you. The study and what we learn from it is really for somebody else in the future, some other patient that I'm going to be talking to 3 years from now or 5 years from now. But at the same time, the treatment, the therapy that's associated with this clinical trial, that is for you. And so it's important to keep those two things clear as we talk about this. And I want patients to understand that. The other reason to think about doing clinical trials if you're a patient is it really provides you access to the latest. Clinical trials is where the most promising new therapies for indolent lymphoma are receiving their testing. And Dr. Leonard and I have seen this many times with our own eyes where we had patients who had been through a lot of standard therapies and were really having limited treatment options moving forward. But because we had novel, innovative treatments, things that weren't necessarily FDA approved yet, but things that were in the pipeline and in development, and we were able to offer those to our patients, we've seen tremendous benefit in many, many instances where standard therapies were just not performing adequately anymore. So it is an opportunity for patients to receive the very latest in treatments. And a lot of patients will also notice that they receive a little extra special attention from the clinic, from the office, from the study coordinators, and some patients find that to be a satisfying experience, the extra attention they get when they're participating in clinical trials. Now, there are many types of trials, and it's important to understand the different types and to make sure that the trial that's under consideration is appropriate for you. We generally have what are considered phases of studies. We have phase one studies, we have phase two, and we have phase three studies. And phase one studies are generally when we're working with a drug that's very new, maybe being tested in humans very early, sometimes even the first time, and we're still trying to sort out the dose, the proper dose to administer. Or sometimes we're taking a relatively new drug and we're combining it with a standard treatment, but we're not exactly sure how best to combine it, and that will be done as part of a phase one study. So a lot of the work of a phase one study is trying to optimize the dose and schedule of a particular drug or a particular drug combination. Those types of trials are generally reserved for patients for whom standard therapies are not very good options anymore. Phase two clinical trials are studies that we utilize when we have worked out the dose and schedule of a new drug or a new regimen, and we really want to see how well it works in a certain patient population. So we might want to test it in follicular lymphoma or in marginal zone lymphoma or in MALT lymphoma or in maybe a combination of those things so we can get a really good signal on how well this therapy works in a particular patient population. And so it's very common for us to participate in phase two clinical trials. Phase three clinical trials are generally comparative studies. They're usually very large studies, often take several years to complete. And usually when you're conducting a phase three study, what you have are two outstanding treatment options that are being compared against one another. And what we're trying to establish in a phase three trial is if one treatment is actually better than another. And you could define better in a variety of ways. Usually we're looking at activity, how effective the regimen is. But we're looking at everything, including the toxicity profile and the quality of life, and then you will integrate all of that information, the efficacy of the regimen, the toxicity of the regimen, and the quality of life for those patients going through those regimens, and you will try to pick a winner, which would then become a new standard. So often when we're conducting phase three clinical trials, patients are asked to participate in what's called randomization. And this is something that is not very intuitive for patients, and understandably so. When we conduct randomized clinical trials, the patient does not pick which of the two treatments they are to receive, and the doctor does not pick which of the two treatments they are to receive. It's literally chosen by a computer. And we have to do it that way. Because when we're conducting a phase three clinical trial, it's just essential. It's vitally important that the two groups of patients that we're going to be comparing at the end of the trial are comparable. They need to be of approximately the same age and approximately the same status for their disease and the same tumor burden and all the important characteristics. Because the danger, if you don't randomize in that fashion and you allow physicians or patients to pick, you can end up with imbalance. And, for example, you could end up on one arm of a study has older patients and the other arm has younger patients, and it's possible that the older patients will not fare as well. And you would conclude, possibly inappropriately, that one treatment regimen was superior to another when in fact it really wasn't. And that's a mistake that we just don't want to make. That's a terrible thing to do, to claim that a regimen is better than another when it's really not the case. And so this randomization is just critically important in clinical research, and we spend a lot of time talking to our patients about the randomization process. And sometimes patients will say, well, just pick which one is better, which is an understandable question. And, you know, to be honest, if I knew which treatment was better, I would pick it for you. But these are instances where we just don't know which treatment is better, and that's really the whole point of the clinical trial. These studies come from a variety of sources. Sometimes the studies are written by investigators like myself or Dr. Leonard. Sometimes the studies come from the pharmaceutical industry, and they're interested in developing a novel agent that they have in a development strategy. And sometimes the trials come from the federal government. And we have a system in the United States called the National Cooperative Group System. And this is a chance for me to make a little plug. This is where we need patients and we need family members to lobby. We need them to advocate. The funding for federally funded cancer clinical research is woefully inadequate, and it's actually diminishing. And we're seeing incredible cuts, which we believe is slowing our progress in the war on cancer. And so if you ever find yourself with the opportunity to talk to your representatives, your elected officials about this, please take advantage of that opportunity. So I'm going to shift gears now, and I'm just going to talk for a minute about a couple of other issues, such as adherence issues. One of the things that we are experiencing now in lymphoma patients, and other diseases have been dealing with this for years, like the disease called myeloma, is increasingly our new agents are pills or oral agents. And it's always a challenge for patients when their anti-cancer therapy is a chronic therapy or a daily oral therapy. And we have to be concerned about patients taking the medication as prescribed and missing doses. And I think the best thing I can tell you in those instances is just try to be organized. Sometimes pill boxes can be very helpful in these instances, and you can plan out your week's medications in advance. And it's very important to have a routine where you try to take your medications at the same time every day, and that helps promote compliance. I was asked to talk a little bit about managing treatment side effects. And this is really a big topic, and it's hard to encapsulate it in a concise way. Side effects are really going to be treatment dependent. And I think simplistically, you could kind of break treatments down into two strategies. We have a lot of our treatments are given in really kind of a pulse fashion. So John described treatments with regimens such as rituximab and bendamustine or rituximab and CHOP chemotherapy. And these are treatments that are typically given in a pulse fashion where you will do the treatment for maybe 4 to 6 months and then you'll stop the treatment. And so usually the side effects or the major side effects are limited to the period of time while the patient is on treatment, and it's a short-term issue. And so if people are dealing with things like fatigue, which is very common with those regimens, the good news is the fatigue and the loss of stamina that comes with that kind of a therapy tends to dissipate after the therapy is completed. And for most of our patients, we find that they get back to their normal energy level once they get a few months out from the therapy. And the best thing to do while you're going through the therapy is really just modify your schedule, your goals, and your expectations for what you can accomplish in a day. Because some side effects of chemotherapy you just can't overcome. You just really need to adjust your schedule accordingly. If it's things like nausea or vomiting, we have very good medicines nowadays to prevent that or deal with it if it occurs. Neuropathy is a toxicity that we take very seriously because neuropathy can be one of the side effects that can be long-lasting. And so if you're on a chemotherapy program that can cause nerve damage, you will hear your physician ask you about that with every visit, because sometimes we can do prospective dose modifications that can avoid long-lasting problems from neuropathy. And then if a patient's on a chronic therapy, a long-term therapy, that's kind of a different ball game, because what the patient can experience is very mild side effects, but they happen every day. And so then you have to come up with a different strategy, because it's not like that's going to go away when you stop the treatment. And so we'll work very hard with our patients to come up with strategies to deal with whatever toxicity. If it's a little nausea or a little stomach upset, we can come up with strategies to deal with that. Or if it's diarrhea or if it's fatigue. And with the chronic daily therapy, sometimes we can do dose modifications that can really ameliorate the side effects and without losing treatment efficacy. And so I think the main thing I want to communicate there is it's just really important to communicate these things to your physician and work with them. Sometimes there's a little bit of trial and error that has to occur as you work through different side effect and toxicity profiles. And if you just hang in there within a cycle or two, you can work through these things and figure out what the best strategy is. I think with that, I will stop my planned presentation. We can move on to the next speaker, but I know we wanted to leave plenty of time for questions.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kahl. It was excellent and very, very comprehensive as well, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Caroline Edlund. Caroline is an oncology social worker, and she's clinical coordinator of our online services at Cancer Care. And Caroline is going to discuss with you the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. So I'd like to start by speaking a little bit about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with indolent lymphoma and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Now, Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to talk with other people impacted by indolent lymphoma, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. So as we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and try to make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and for your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you so much for your attention today.
Oh, thank you so much, Caroline. Excellent. And it's good for everyone to know about this resource and to take advantage of it and to use it as you need to. And now we have time for questions. We have actually a lot of time for questions so that we're going to start with our first question. There is a question online already, but actually we probably should give directions to how to queue up for questions because everyone may not know what to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from the line of Vilma C. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. I was diagnosed in September 2009 when my small bowel perforated. The bowel was resected, of course. The cause of the perforation was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, stage 1 marginal B-cell lymphoma. I understand lymphoma doesn't usually present this way. I was treated only with Rituxan once weekly for 4 weeks in December 2009.
And Vilma, your question?
Oh, okay. Everything has been negative since 2010. I'd like to know your thoughts, please. Thank you.
Oh, Vilma, thank you for your excellent question. Dr. Lund, would you like to address that question in a general way? And then Vilma will certainly encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team as well. Dr. Leonard?
Yes, well, it's certainly difficult to give a general answer to a specific problem, but I would say that in general, patients that have gotten a course of therapy for indolent lymphoma and are in remission typically are monitored. And the question is, how exactly do you monitor in that situation? And someone who's been in remission for several years, it should be obviously happy that they're in remission and doing well, meaning their disease has been quiet. And typically we would see patients in that sort of scenario for routine follow-up visits. The typical pattern varies a little bit on the physician and the patient's individual situation, but typically what we would do is see a patient every 4 months, every 6 months, sometimes once a year, depending on what the situation was and what we were concerned about. And the most important things are really to do a physical examination, to feel on examination, are there signs of any lymphoma going on? Are there any symptoms that the patient's having? So to ask some questions very carefully to see, are there hints that something's happening? And to check some blood work. To see are there any signs that the lymphoma is affecting the blood. So for someone who's been in a remission for some time, that would be the typical pattern of monitoring. There's been some controversy about whether or not one needs to do regular scans of one sort or another, and it wouldn't surprise me if we come back to that question later. But the bottom line of that is that if one is feeling well and there's not much to find, so to speak, on examination, that it's unlikely that you will find a whole lot on scans. And so the mainstay is really just periodically seeing the physician at regular intervals and checking in to make sure that there's no signs that anything is going on, and obviously enjoying periods of being away from the doctor and away from having to have treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I have a question for one of our online participants, actually, which came up before we even asked the Q&A. Can an aggressive cancer come back indolent? Dr. Kahl, could you address that in a general way?
Sure. Yeah, the answer to that is yes. It's complicated biologically, but we do see this from time to time where we will have a patient who has a diagnosis of an aggressive lymphoma. The most common aggressive lymphoma that we see and treat is called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and we treat patients for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and they go into remission, and they're doing well, and then we see a disease recurrence at some point later, and many times then we will repeat a biopsy because we know this can happen, and when we repeat a biopsy, when the disease comes back, it actually is an indolent lymphoma. It could be follicular lymphoma or marginal zone or MALT lymphoma. Most common would be a follicular lymphoma, however. And the presumption in situations like that was that the patient had an underlying follicular lymphoma all along, but it was sort of masked by the more aggressive lymphoma, and that had overtaken the presentation, and it was the dominant feature at the time of disease diagnosis. In many instances, there's no way to know that at the time of the original diagnosis, and the initial treatment was totally appropriate. And so when that happens, then we now have a patient who hopefully has had their diffuse large B-cell lymphoma eradicated, and now we're dealing with the indolent version of the lymphoma, usually follicular lymphoma, and then all the management principles that John Leonard outlined in the beginning of his talk would then apply going forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have another question for one of our online participants. The question is there any evidence that radiation therapy is effective in curing or prolonging remission in non-Hodgkin's follicular lymphoma, stage 1, grade 1? Dr. Leonard?
So it's an interesting question, and there are different perspectives on this. The typical scenarios for indolent lymphoma where radiation can be used is really in two main areas. The first is if the disease is localized in some cases, and we'll come back to that in one second. The second case is really sometimes used as palliation to try to control the disease at some point after a number of prior therapies. If the treatments aren't working so well, radiation can be a useful option. The first scenario, which I think is what the caller is getting at, relates to the idea that in some cases follicular lymphoma can be what we call limited stage, where it appears to be in one particular area only. And historically, patients were treated with follicular lymphoma if they had really one site or one area of disease with radiation treatment. And that goes back to the 1960s. And in part because radiation was an effective treatment modality, and in part because the disease was really in just one place, so it was feasible to aim a radioactive beam in the radiation process to a localized area. Now, the reality is that there are people who have been treated with radiation and for localized follicular lymphoma or other indolent lymphomas who have stayed in remission for many years. And when I say many years, I would say at least 10 to 20 years, if not longer in some cases. Whether or not that's a cure is a challenging thing because some patients can get treatments, standard treatments in many different scenarios and have very long remissions. So it's a challenging thing to say that someone is cured in follicular lymphoma, although some would argue that that's potentially the case in certain scenarios. Now, that being said, there have since that time been a variety of different studies that have suggested that observing patients with indolent lymphoma that is localized can result in patients doing well for many years. Some of the same or different studies have shown that actually giving chemotherapy or giving rituximab or giving combinations of chemotherapy and rituximab with or without radiation can also result in people doing well for many years. So the point is that there are people with follicular lymphoma and other indolent lymphomas that seems to be localized that can do very well for many years with a variety of different treatments, which may or may not include radiation.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of William B. Your line is open.
Thank you. I was diagnosed in 2009 with localized intra-abdominal intrapelvic lymph nodes with the follicular stage 4 B-cell, and opted for an old therapeutic regimen going back to the 70s when I was a resident of chlorambucil, and it took the nodes from 5 centimeters, 4 centimeters in size. They just basically disappeared, and they're just now beginning to come back. No symptoms. Can you take another course of chlorambucil, recognizing, of course, that it can suppress the bone marrow?
Thank you for that excellent question. Thank you. Dr. Carl, can you address that question, please, in a general way? And then we advise for a psychologist to go back to their treating team.
Yeah. So to generalize that question would be, suppose a patient had a therapy, a cytotoxic chemotherapy, or any therapy, really, several years ago, and it worked very well, which they often do, and now the disease is starting to come back slowly, and the question is, can you go back to the same therapy? And the answer is you can. I think what we typically look at in that instance is how effective was the therapy the first time around. If we try a therapy and we get a short remission from it, then we're usually not very enthused about going back to the same regimen the second time around, because if you go back to the same treatment you used before, the remissions tend to be shorter than they were the first time, and that's a pretty predictable phenomenon. If the first remission was very long, then it is a very reasonable thing to go back to the same treatment, although it's unlikely that the treatment will work quite as well as it worked the first time, although it still may work well, just not as well. So it all depends on the length of the first remission. The other point I'll make is that we see this quite often where we catch the disease starting to come back slowly and the patient is asymptomatic. There is no reason that a patient has to rush back into treatment the second things start to grow back. If the tumor burden is low and the patient is asymptomatic, it's perfectly appropriate to do a watching strategy until the disease gets to a higher tumor burden state or symptoms start to develop. And in many instances, that's a better long-term management strategy, because it allows the patient and the physician to save their therapies for later. And as John pointed out in his presentation, this ends up for a lot of patients being a chronic illness that has to be managed successfully over a very long period of time. So it's important to use your treatments thoughtfully and judiciously.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Collett. I hope that was helpful. Our next question from one of our online participants, from Shannon: what other options are there other than a chemo as aggressive as CHOP, essentially those without as many side effects? Dr. Leonard, could you address that question?
Well, I think for patients with indolent lymphoma, there are a number of different options out there. CHOP is one chemo regimen that has been around for some time, and there are a number of patients that have received CHOP, or now more typically R-CHOP, R being the rituximab, that have done very well. CHOP typically has some side effects, such as hair loss, low blood counts, some nausea, some fatigue. However, many people do quite well with R-CHOP and are able to work and do many of their normal things as part of it. So, the element of calling something a strong or toxic chemotherapy to some degree is quite subjective, because many people have benefited from R-CHOP and done quite well with it, although it does have some side effects. For most people, it is manageable, but clearly there are people at both ends of the spectrum with R-CHOP and so on. So R-rituximab, or R-bendamustine, is one chemotherapy regimen that is used that now for indolent lymphomas, both as initial treatment and in the relapse situation, that can be very helpful. And some aspects of R-bendamustine can be less toxic, particularly the hair loss, although R-bendamustine also does have some side effects that are in some ways a little bit worse than R-CHOP. So it is, for some people, a little bit different, but that is an option that patients should talk about with their treating team and really look and see if it's right for them. I think for many situations, chemotherapy is not needed, and one could use rituximab, and there are a number of new drugs that are out there that are available. So The one thing in indolent lymphoma I would say that's very important is that it's hard to generalize. Certain types of lymphoma, it's very clear that there is only one best therapy for a given situation, and you go from treatment A to treatment B to treatment C. I think that it is hard to generalize, and Dr. Call and I can see the same patient, and we might disagree because there are several reasonable options, and we might prefer one or the other, or the patient might prefer one or the other, although there are certain situations where there really is one best option or most preferred option. So it is very, very important, I think, for an individual patient to speak with a physician and the treatment team and say, okay, you're recommending this or you're offering me this treatment. What are the other possibilities out there? What are the pros and cons of this versus other treatments? Because in many cases, there are different options, and you really have to think through the pros and cons of different possibilities. And again, as you heard, clinical trials may present a potentially useful option for many patients, either to try to avoid some of the side effects of treatment or to try to make the standard treatments even better.
Thank you so much. That's really very helpful answer. Thank you. And our next question, Kate?
Our next question comes from the line of Deborah F. Your line is open.
Yes. I was diagnosed with follicular non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at the end of 2009. And after my initial treatment, which was CHOP, I have relapsed three times, although I'm in remission right now. I'm wondering about the best treatments for people who relapse frequently.
Excellent. Thank you, Deborah, for that question. Dr. Cobb, would you address that question?
Sure. This is a very good question, and it really highlights what we call the heterogeneity. A more lay term might be variability in follicular lymphoma and some of the other indolent lymphomas. And so Dr. Leonard and I see this frequently, where you can take one patient and you can treat them with R-CHOP and they go into remission for 8 years. And then the next patient you treat with R-CHOP and their disease is back in 18 months. And there are just things that we just don't fully understand about why cancers do the things they do, and we don't have perfect explanations for that. But what we do know is that when we see somebody their disease coming back after a short interval, after an appropriate aggressive therapy like R-CHOP or R-bendamustine, then that's a signal that we need to think about the disease differently in that person. And that person's disease isn't necessarily going to follow the typical rules of follicular lymphoma or indolent lymphoma. And so we'll often start thinking, I'll use the term outside the box. I don't know if that's the most appropriate term, but things like stem cell transplantation need to be considered in instances like that, depending upon the patient's age, particularly for younger patients. Autologous stem cell transplantation, which basically uses high-dose chemotherapy followed by a rescue with the patient's own stem cells, can be a very useful strategy in follicular lymphoma that has had a short initial remission, or an allogeneic stem cell transplant where the patient receives stem cells from a donor, meaning a brother or a sister or an unrelated donor who has been appropriately matched, can be, in some instances, the best strategy for long-term disease control. And so when I see patients experiencing short remissions, I think those options need to be discussed. And then the other options that should be considered would be novel innovative therapies as part of clinical trials. So I think those are the kinds of things one should be thinking about when short remissions are being observed, rather than just continuing with standard treatments where the results are somewhat predictable at that point.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, Kate?
Our next question comes from the line of Rosemary P. Your line is open.
Hello?
Hello, Rosemary. Hi, your question?
Oh, yes. I didn't realize I was here. I'm calling regarding my sister who has the lymphoma. She lives miles away. She is a candidate for the stem cell transplant. And presently, right now, she's probably still on chemotherapy this afternoon. My question is, I know before they proceed, she cannot have any infections. She has severe infections with her teeth. She has to have several pulled. What can she expect as would be the healing period before she can proceed after her teeth have been? How long would it take for her teeth to be heal from the infection before she could proceed with the auto stem cell? And also, she is going to be a candidate for the clinical trials.
Excellent. Thank you for those excellent questions. I'm going to ask Dr. Leonard if you could address. It's an excellent question about the dental issues. And Dr. Leonard, could you address that in a general way? And then, of course, we will advise our caller to go back to the treating physician team.
Sure. So, number one, thank you for highlighting your sister's interest in clinical trials, and I think this is an example of someone who needs a therapy, maybe getting one of the standard therapies, and for some people, stem cell transplant is a standard therapy. It certainly is for some situations in lymphoma, and so this is an example. I don't know the details of the trial, but certainly there are clinical trials for every scenario that someone might be facing. From the standpoint of doing a stem cell transplant or, frankly, getting any sort of chemotherapy or other therapy for lymphoma, you would ideally like the person to be healthy and in good shape and all systems go and all kind of tuned up, for lack of a better term, before you proceed with the treatment. So on the other hand, those other issues such as dental issues and other potential problems that could come up, and it may be in some cases heart trouble or lung trouble or diabetes or high blood pressure, you'd like to have them all tuned up before you embark on a treatment regimen. On the other hand, you might not be able to for whatever reason. Those situations may be difficult to resolve and so on. This is particularly important for people getting stem cell transplants because that involves a period of infection risk and other things. And so you would like to go into that procedure kind of with all systems go, at least as best you can. And you may be able to wait get all of these issues taken care of, or you might not be able to because the disease or the overall situation really is not amenable to waiting a long period of time to resolve other medical issues. So this is a very individualized thing. I think the take-home point is that if there are other medical issues that could complicate a treatment regimen, whether it's a transplant or something else, make sure your doctor and your treatment team are aware of it so that they're not surprised, that they can help you get it resolved quickly and can give you the appropriate guidance to say this is what you need to do so that we can move on with your treatment regimen and get your lymphoma taken care of with as little delay and complication as possible.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. You've just been extraordinary today. And I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions online or on the telephone, and those of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So I do want to again remind you about the services that Caroline Edlin so eloquently described to all of you, that Cancer Care is here for you, and you can simply call us at our 1-800-813-HOPE number, our HOPE line, and our staff are here, our oncology social workers are here to answer your questions. If you didn't get to ask a question or think of a question, please do call us. We're here to be of help. Also, we offer a range of services from practical and financial assistance to supportive counseling to support groups. Both those support groups are online on the telephone as well. And we have lots of materials, fact sheets and booklets, and, of course, these workshops as well. So we have a variety of services, and I would encourage you to take advantage of them and to give us a call. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, particularly at this time of the year, I don't want anyone to think that you are alone in coping with lymphoma. I want you to know that you're now part of this community of support. We're here to help you. And I know with this kind of holiday time of year, sometimes people even feel more alone and feel like there's no one there for them. And I want you to know that we are here for you, and all you have to do is really call us for any question or concern you may have. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.